My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. The word Israel, for most, reflects the name of a nation or a people. It derives from the biblical patriarch Jacob, who, after wrestling with an angel, is given the name Israel, meaning he who struggles with God. Every sentient human being, whether a believer, agnostic, or atheist, can share the name Israel because we all struggle with God. How can we make sense and find meaning and connection with the divine in a world that so often seems devoid of the foundational message of all faiths, love? Or are we actually experiencing and witnessing it every day and perhaps not recognizing it, even when it's right in front of us? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, famed journalist, commentator, and author Sally Quinn, has lived and lives this journey of discovery. Sally is a longtime Washington Post journalist, columnist, television commentator, renowned Washington, D.C. social hostess, and founder of the Washington Post website On Faith. She's the author of several books and joins us this evening to discuss her captivating new book, Finding Magic, A Personal Memoir. Please welcome Sally Quinn. Good evening, Sally.
Hi, good evening.
So nice to have you with us, and thank you for taking the time to share your experience with us tonight.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Sally, let's begin with your childhood in Savannah and Statesboro, Georgia, and the fundamental experiences that began shaping your understanding of the mysteries of life.
I grew up as an Army brat, but my mother was from Savannah, Georgia, and she grew up part of her life in Statesboro, which is a tiny town right outside of Savannah. And I was born in Savannah and spent my summers in Statesboro, particularly during the war, World War II and the Korean War, when my father was away fighting. And my mother's family were all Scots, MacDougals, who had come over from Scotland to North Carolina and then followed the turpentine trade down to Statesboro, where they built a huge plantation house right out of Gone with the Wind. And my Aunt Ruth, my mother's aunt, lived in this big, beautiful house where we stayed in the summers. And it had white columns and a great, long, wide hallway that ran the length of the house. And my Aunt Ruth was a Scottish Presbyterian lady, you know, who wore little lace collars and played the organ in church. But she also had another spiritual life, which was the life of the Scottish mysteries. She believed in the stones and psychic phenomenon and time travel and all kinds of spiritual things, the occult, the tarot cards, palmistry, astrology, ghosts. And so we were brought up with sort of these two conflicting views of religion. There was this sort of institutional religion of the Presbyterian Church, and then there was all of this other stuff, which was really what I think we call embedded religion. It's the religion that you're sort of brought up with, although we didn't think of that as a religion. And the other thing was that we had staff who were all black, and they were, some of them, descendants of slaves who had worked for the MacDougall family, and they would go to their Baptist church on their side of town on Sundays. But they also practiced voodoo, and that was very much a part of their spiritual lives. And they had voodoo ceremonies that I saw and witnessed in the house. And that was part of my embedded religion also, so that I had these two ideas of what religion was like. And for some reason, I always felt that institutional religion was the legitimate religion, and that this other stuff, the psychic and the occult and the mysterious and the phenomenon, the supernatural, was not legitimate. And for years, in fact, until I started writing this book, I always thought it was not really legitimate. And then I realized one day that it's all magic, and that all religion is magic, and that the embedded religion, as for instance, if you're a Catholic and you grow up and you believe that you know, that you're going to go to hell if you sin, and even when you get older and you decide that that isn't the case and you don't believe it, intellectually you don't believe it, but there's still some fear or some emotional or feeling that it might be true, or what they call Catholic guilt or Jewish guilt or whatever you're brought up with, whether you're Muslim or Hindu or Christian, you always have this, if you're brought up with it, this embedded religion that just keeps coming back at you constantly. And so for me, that was the foundation of my religious life and my spiritual life.
How did your mother and your Aunt Ruth regard this dichotomy between the Christian faith and the Celtic and Voodoo traditions? Was there anything said about it at the time?
Never. That's the thing that was interesting, is that they incorporated it. They somehow compartmentalized it. And I mean, you find, I mean, there's so many people who are in the world of the supernatural. I mean, people who are psychic and people who are astrologers and people who are tarot card readers or palmists who are also practicing Christians or practicing Muslims or whatever. It doesn't, it only sort of enhances their faith. So I think that it was a sort of another level that they were on when they got involved in the mysterious. And when you talk about, for instance, Jesus Christ walking on water, that's magic. And so if you're going to church and you're reading this or singing about it or listening to sermons about it, it doesn't seem so strange when you come home and you're practicing another form of religion or mystery or magic or meaning, that it doesn't seem so far-fetched.
Absolutely. When I was a child, I was the child of basically an interfaith marriage in which my mother converted to Judaism when she married my father. And I was very close to my paternal grandfather, who was Orthodox, who was a mystic, and who would talk to me. He was in his late 80s when I was a child, and would talk to me as a peer. And I had an understanding from him that there was a difference between orthodoxy and religion, and this practice of mysticism and this understanding, this feeling of connection with spirit, feeling connection with divine, that really had nothing to do with the more intellectual pursuits of religion. Did you find that also in your growing up?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and as I write in my book, I became an atheist when I was 4 years old, even though I didn't know the meaning of that word. And so the only religion I really did have to fall back on was my view of the mystical and the magical. But I mean, the thing that, for instance, I have so many Jewish friends who basically will call themselves atheists, and yet they'll go to the High Holy Days. You know, they'll go to Kol Nidre, and they'll go to Yom Kippur, and they'll go to Rosh Hashanah, and they will, you know, they'll celebrate Passover at their seders. And so many of the Jewish rituals I find wonderful. I mean, Shabbat, for instance. I was at a Shabbat dinner last night, as a matter of fact. And you invoke the mystical in those practices, which are, and this is true of my Jewish friends, who are the same people that I had Shabbat dinner with, would say that they were atheists. And yet they go to these rituals and they make these observances and these celebrations. And part of the reason they do it, and I find, for instance, I go to Yom Kippur, I go to the temple for Yom Kippur every year, I find it just a transcendent experience. And so I think that even no matter whether you call yourself a believer or not, we are all looking for magic, and we are all looking, and magic can be, you can describe it any way you want, but for me, it's the transcendent and the idea of being in touch with the divine, and we can all have that.
It's fascinating to me because as a child, my father was not particularly spiritual or religious at all. My grandfather was. But I found a tremendous amount of joy going with my friends to church, and especially going to church on Christmas and going to midnight mass and feeling that sense of transcendence and wondering if I was doing something wrong in the process.
Well, I put in my book that the first time I went to a Catholic church was with a friend of mine. I spent the night at her house, and we went to church the next day. And at that point, I was an atheist. I was 10, I think, maybe a little younger. And I didn't even know what to expect. I mean, all I'd heard about Catholics were that they were mackerel snappers, because that meant they didn't eat fish on Friday. And I was just overwhelmed with the mass, because it was all of these robes and ringing bells and incense and this, and the chanting and the Latin. And of course, they weren't saying anything I couldn't believe, because I didn't understand what they were saying. So that it was just incredible, mystical and transcendent experience. And I had another experience like that when I was in Greece at 13, when I went to Easter services at a Greek Orthodox church at night, and it was all candles, and they were throwing rose petals on the floor, and people were wearing crowns and robes, and I looked at their faces, and they were just filled with awe and wonder, and I thought, I want that. I want to be part of that community. I want to feel that. But I sort of did. I felt the sort of transcendent feeling, even though I didn't believe in the God that they believed in at that time, because I didn't even know what God meant. But yes, I mean, all of these ceremonies and all of these rituals invoke a certain kind of longing, I think, in all of us, for something larger than ourselves.
My guest is Sally Quinn. Her book, Finding Magic, A Spiritual Memoir, will be back with more of Sally after these words from the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket, a tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of Hurricane Harvey, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit HurricaneHarveyAid.org. That's HurricaneHarveyAid.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Sylvia Henderson, intuitive life coach and energy healer. Are you ready to elevate and rise way above your normal? Be sure to listen to my show, Intuitive Transformations, on OM Times Radio, Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. Get the inspiration you need to transform your life.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening, Sally Quinn. She's the author of the new book, Finding Magic, A Spiritual Memoir. So we were talking about your mother and your great aunt, who were both psychically gifted. What was it like to have people close to you who had these abilities?
I didn't think anything of it. It just was part of our lives. I mean, it would be like having your mother be a good cook, you know? That's what it is, and that's my mother would see things in the future. My Aunt Ruth was really psychic. My mother's mother, who died when my mother was 2 years old, predicted her own death. My Aunt Maggie was incredibly psychic, and there's one story in the book where she was living in in Fort Pierce, Florida, and she woke up in the middle of the night screaming and said to her husband, there's been a terrible plane crash in the Okefenokee Swamp. And they contacted the authorities and they said, well, yes, the plane has gone down. And she told them exactly where the plane was. And so these were all stories that we just sort of understood to be true. And, you know, there was the McDougal House was haunted, of course, and all of the ancestors would go up and down the hallway at night, and if somebody died, like when my uncle Horace died, there would be chains would rattle up and down the floor of the hallway that you went from one end of the house to the other. And right after Uncle Horace died, we were there. There was a terrible thunderstorm, and I was terrified. I got in bed with my mother, and you could hear the howls and screams and the chains rattling up and down the hallway. And the next morning, my Aunt Ruth took us upstairs, and there were scratches on the floor in the hallway. My Aunt Ruth had a heart condition, and she dreamt one night that her mother came to her and told her that she knew that she was worried about her heart, but that she shouldn't, because she was going to be fine. And her mother said, just to prove that I was here, I want you to go into the parlor tomorrow morning when you get up and look on the divan. I've left something there for you. And so Ruth did, and there on the divan was the shawl that her mother had been buried in. Mm. Now, all of these stories are stories that I grew up hearing, and so I didn't think anything of them. If you grow up hearing that Jesus was born in a manger and it was a virgin birth and the three wise men saw a star and came to him, and or if you're Hindu and you believe in many gods, or Muslim and you believe that Muhammad ascended heaven on a silver steed, you know, you grow up believing that, you don't think anything of it. It's not unusual.
You talked about the chains with the ghosts. What do you think the significance of that was?
My feeling is that they just wanted to say, don't forget me. Mm. I'm here. I talk in my book later about having contacted my husband, Ben, after he died through a medium, and it's kind of the same thing. It's just I'm still here, so don't count me out.
It's funny, because when you think of chains in relationship to ghosts or spirits, you think of being bound to the earth, that they haven't had the opportunity to move on.
Well, if the chains are being dragged up and down the hallway, it means that whoever is dragging the chains has escaped them. So, I hadn't actually given it that much thought, but I would think that it would be, I'm liberated now. I'm not chained anymore.
Mm. When did you first realize that you had psychic abilities?
Very early on. Just little things. I can't remember the first time, but I do know that the phone would ring and you'd know somebody was there before you picked it up. And a lot of people, the thing is, a lot of people have psychic abilities that they don't even realize, that they can't even get in touch with because they haven't been developed. And I do believe that if you really want to, you can develop your psychic abilities. I've never worked on it before just because I find it very unsettling. I'm not really happy about it. And I don't have it all the time. It comes and goes. So there are times when I feel really, like my antenna is just up quivering, way up there picking up all kinds of signals and information, and other times where I'm just blanked. But I do remember walking home when I was 6 years old, walking home from school, and I remember what I was wearing. It was a beautiful September afternoon or fall afternoon, and I had on a little black and white pinafore and my black patent leather Mary Janes, and I was so happy, and the sun was dappling through the trees. And all of a sudden, I had this horrible, horrible feeling that something awful has happened to my mother. And I'm particularly psychic about my mother and about Ben and about Quinn, the people I'm close to. And I started running back to the house as fast as I could. And I got there, and Mother always made custard for me when I came home from school, and there was the smell of custard, and I was so happy. I thought, well, I'm wrong. And then we sat down at the kitchen table, and she put her head in her hands, and she said she had a terrible headache and she didn't feel well. And when Daddy came home from work, she had to go lie down, and he was really worried about her, and so was I. And we went to bed, and he took her to the emergency room that night. And she had polio, and that was really at the end of the summer, the terrible summer, the polio epidemic, where all the pools were closed and nobody was allowed to go out at all. And my mother had lumbar polio, which is the worst kind. And the doctors didn't think she'd survive, but certainly never walk again. And she might even have to be in an iron lung. And I was absolutely devastated. She beat it, and she got better. And I willed her to get better, and she willed herself to get better, and she did, and she recovered completely. But that was my earliest memory of having a psychic experience.
You share another experience where, in essence, your action to received information in your mind actually saved your mom's life.
I went to Smith College, and I was in the dorm one afternoon, and I suddenly was overwhelmed with this sense that something terrible was happening to my mother. And I ran to the phone in the hallway, and I called home, and the phone rang and rang and rang and rang, and nobody answered it. And it was unusual, because we lived in army quarters at that time. There were always two or three orderlies who lived in the house with us, and my mother was usually home at that time in the afternoon. And I didn't put the phone down. I just kept letting it ring, and it just kept ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing, and nobody answered 50 times at least, maybe more. I was desperate. I was hysterical. And finally, the phone was answered by one of the orderlies. And I said, "Is my mother there?" And he said, "Well, something's happened." And I said, "What's happened?" And he said, "Well, she was in the bathtub and she almost drowned." And so he finally put my mother on, who was hysterical. And it turned out that one of the GIs who lived at Fort Myer had come into the house and wanted to rob the house, and had gone up to the bedroom and seen my mother in the bathtub, and he got scared because he thought that she would recognize him, so he took his jacket and put it over her head and pushed her under the water and was drowning her when the phone started to ring. And he kept trying to drown her and drown her, and the phone kept ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. Then he got scared because he thought that maybe somebody would hear it, or somebody outside, and he better get out of the house before somebody heard or answered the phone. And so he ran, my mother was about to drown. And so she was able to pull her face up out of the water, and she got out of the tub and was screaming hysterically. And one of the orderlies heard her and heard the phone and came running upstairs. And they later found a lot of my father's things that had been on his dresser. This guy had been in the house more than once. And when he was in court during the trial, he was sentenced to prison. He said that what made him stop trying to drown my mother was the phone ringing, because he got scared and he ran out of the house.
Which shows the importance of acknowledging and responding to the impressions and information that come to us, even though they're coming from an etheric place, that it's so important to listen to the messages and try and validate them. I know when in 1975 I was in the Air Force, I was stationed in Korea, and one day I had this sense early in the morning that there was something wrong with my mother back here in New York, and I called, and my mother and sister picked up the extensions of the phone simultaneously, and I said to my mother, "What's wrong?" And my sister said, "Oh my God, how did he find out?" And it turned out that she was scheduled for major surgery the next day, which she came through fine, and I told her she would be fine. And I think my phone call to her was important for her to hear my voice saying, "Mom, you're going to be okay." So when you get that type of message, it's so important to respond to it.
Yes, and I don't think that, I mean, as I said earlier, I think a lot of people have these experiences. I think that, you know, I believe in telepathy, and I certainly have telepathic experiences with people I care about particularly, and just being able to send messages to them and get messages back. So I always pay attention to them. And I think, you know, people who will sort of scoff at this kind of thing would have not believed 150 years ago that there would be such a thing as a telephone or a television, and certainly not the internet and cell phones and all of that. So I think it's only a matter of time before we're able to communicate without even talking to each other, which I find terrifying, because then people would know what you're thinking all the time. Oh, you look darling today, when you know they know that you're saying that you look terrible. So I'm not sure I'm looking forward to those days, but I do think it's just a matter of time before we all are able to use our antenna and use the resources we have to communicate in another way.
Maybe in those days, honesty will just come naturally because there'll be no need for anyone to hide. They can't hide anymore at that point.
I don't know whether that's a great idea, but anyway.
Absolutely. My guest is Sally Quinn. She's the author of the brand new book, Finding Magic, A Spiritual Memoir. Sally, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about all of this amazing work that you do.
It will be on sale September the 12th. It's being published by HarperOne, which is the largest publisher of religion books in the world. HarperCollins is the mother publisher. And it should be, I'm hoping, will be on sale in most bookstores in the country. So, and I know you can pre-order on Amazon, because I have some friends who've already done that.
There you go. And your website?
My website, well, I'm setting up a Facebook site at the moment, so that will be available in another couple of weeks.
And we'll be back with more of Finding Magic and Sally Quinn after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
Are you in an interfaith relationship and thinking of getting married? For 18 years, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway has been creating personalized, loving, and romantic ceremonies for couples of all faiths and cultural backgrounds. Reverend Lori Sue's sensitivity to the needs of interfaith couples is reflected in the compassionate and inclusive way she addresses the concerns of parents and families. Reverend Lori Sue is also the author of several best-selling books on interfaith weddings and wedding vows. Selected as one of the top interfaith officiants by New York Magazine, Reverend Lori Sue serves couples in the New York metropolitan area and beyond. Find out more at her website, yourinterfaithwedding.com.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
I want to be a warm fleece on a cold
day. I want to
be
a football stadium.
I want to be a bike that races around the country.
I want to be a bench on a forest trail.
When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. Brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Sally Quinn, author of the new book, Finding Magic, A Spiritual Memoir. So, Sally, you share a lot of intimate and personal stories connected with your early years and your development. At what point in your life, what made you lose your faith in the existence of God?
I always believed in God when I was little. I remember saying my prayers. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. I believed in God. I believed that Jesus was the Son of God. But my father was in World War II, and he was there on the day that Dachau, the Nazi concentration camp, was liberated. And he had his staff photographer take a lot of pictures. And when he came home, he made a scrapbook of these photographs, which he hid in a cabinet in the study. And one day I was looking for something in the cabinet and I found these scrapbooks and I looked at them and I was absolutely horrified. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I knew, all I knew at that time, because I was four, my daddy had just gotten back from World War II in 1945. All I knew was that daddy, that, you know, we didn't have television then and that I didn't read the newspapers, but that he was fighting the bad guys and they were called Nazis. And that's really all I knew. And so, but I was just so horrified, but I kept sneaking back and looking at these pictures and they were all piles of dead bodies that looked like skeletons and then living bodies that looked like skeletons, emaciated people in these striped uniforms and just devastation everywhere. And American soldiers in these pictures looking with horror at these people that they saw. And so finally I asked my mother about it and she told my father, and they were upset that I had found the scrapbooks, but I had a conversation. Daddy sat me down on his knee that night and went over the scrapbooks and explained to me about Hitler and the Nazis and World War II and what he was doing and why he had gone there and that what they were doing to the Jews. And when he finished explaining this to me, I said to him, "Daddy, did God know about this?" And my father said, "Yes, he did." And I said, "But then why did he let that happen?" And my father said, "Well, God is a mystery, and we don't know sometimes why he lets things happen." And so from that time on, I decided that there was no God, because as I was saying my prayers at night, all of those people in the concentration camp, all of those little children who watched their parents perish and who died themselves, were praying to the same God, and he didn't listen to them. And so I just assumed that there was no God, because if there was a good, all-loving, omniscient, an omnipotent God, he would never have allowed this to happen. And so that's when I stopped believing in God. And it wasn't until I was age 13 that I actually learned the word atheist, but I never did believe in God after that, or at least in a God, a loving, all-loving, caring God.
Now, you talk in the book about, even though you had rejected the concept of God per se, that you still had a connection with the energy of Jesus. Talk about that a little, please.
Well, I didn't blame Jesus when I was a child, because I thought Jesus didn't really have anything to do with it. And I thought Jesus was a wonderful person. And I still think that Jesus was an extraordinary human being and a great prophet. I don't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, but I do believe that he was, well, one of a kind. I can't explain Jesus except to say that he was an extraordinary prophet. One of the things that was difficult for me was to, in believing in God, was that God, if God loved everybody and cared for everybody, how could he possibly allow something so horrible to happen to his own son? So I felt sorry for Jesus. And I thought that Jesus had come into the world to try to make the world a better place and try to bring goodness into the world. But I didn't see necessarily that he was bringing goodness from God, since God had allowed all these horrible things to happen, including allowing his own son to be crucified.
Now, even though you had rejected the concept of God per se, as we talked about before, we've had these experiences of transcendence. Talk about how they affected your spiritual path.
Well, I do believe in a creator. I just can't get my mind around the idea that there was nothing and then there was something. My human brain can't comprehend the fact that there wasn't some creator, something, or somebody who created the universe and all of that. But I don't see that as someone that I would pray to necessarily or to worship. However, I do think that what has been created has allowed a sense of divine and a sense of transcendence and mystery and magic to imbue our lives. And I think that we can all get in touch with that, so that when we're looking for meaning in our lives, I talked to an atheist friend of mine, because I no longer call myself an atheist. But I was talking to an atheist friend of mine, and I said, there must be something in your life that gives you a sense of transcendence or magic or mystery. And he said, no, there's nothing. And I said, well, what about when you held your child in your arms for the first time? He said, well, that was great. I loved it, but I didn't feel any overwhelming sense of transcendence. I don't believe that. I think that you look for magic and you look for signs of the divine, and you will find them everywhere, even despite all the suffering in the world. So that, I mean, one of the things I talk about is when I had Quinn, my son, and I nursed him for the first time, and I just thought, there is a God. I mean, I just can't. There has to be something who has created some kind of magic that we are having together, as he's looking into my eyes and I'm looking into his eyes and I am nursing him. And I felt the same way the first time I made love to my husband. That it was some sort of a holy communion, and there was some sense of the divine there. And, it's trite to talk about the sunset and the stars and the moon and, you know, the oceans and the mountains and all of those things, but when you look at the idea that people can love other people, that is something that is so close to the divine. That is sacred, that is holy, and that comes from somewhere other than what we human beings can comprehend.
It's almost as if we have to separate the mind from the feeling to experience this.
Yes, well, one of the things that I talk about is that, and I say this in my prologue, is that I feel bad that I didn't kind of connect these things in the beginning of my life. That it was just had to be black or white. Everything was either good or bad, and there was either no God or there was a God, and I didn't believe in a God. And the fact is that there is something there for everyone, and that what I said was that I just wish that most people wouldn't make the same mistake I did in rejecting the unknowable and the unseeable, because that's where the mystery is, that's where the magic is. And there's so much that we can't know and can't see. I mean, one of the reasons that I don't call myself an atheist anymore, my friend John Meacham, who was a co-moderator with me on faith, and who's a religion scholar and also a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. But John said to me, you're not an atheist. And I was saying, yes, I am. Yes, I am. No, you're not. Yes, I am. Well, he said, you know, you're not a negative person. And if you're an atheist, you deny the existence of God. And I don't see you as a negative person. And he's right, because I don't deny the existence of God. How could I possibly know? On the other hand, the word agnostic has no meaning for me, because it means you don't know. And I think we're all agnostics, including the Pope, because he doesn't know any more than I do. I saw a wonderful bumper sticker the other day that said, I don't know and you don't either. And the fact is that, you know, he believes, and that's great. He believes that there's a God, and I don't know what his God looks like. It looks different from everybody else's God, because nobody's God is the same. But I find that having this belief in something that's bigger than myself has been hugely important to me in my life, and has given me enormous amount of comfort and solace.
Absolutely. We talked about transcendence. What other things, without having to get into the concept of labels and definitions, if we take the word magic and add transcendence, what other qualities could we add to the word magic?
Well, my book is divided into three sections. Magic, mystery, and meaning. So certainly mystery, the mysterious, the unknown, the sacred, the divine, I can't think of another word right now, but I mean, it's magic is something that you either believe in or you don't. And magic is something, I believe that magic is something that is so available to everybody. And it's not just somebody doing magic tricks. It's not somebody just doing magic tricks and pulling a rabbit out of the house, out of the hat. But it is, I believe in divine synchronicity. You know, it's when, I don't think that there are coincidences, so that when something happens, I just give you an example of, I'm starting to write a novel now, and one of the main characters in my novel is a Catholic priest, actually the Archbishop of Dublin, and I'm heading out to Ireland to do some research on it. And so in my novel, the priest is a big fan of William Butler Yeats, and he quotes Yeats, and he carries a book of Yeats around with him. And I've been trying to get a hold of some Yeats scholars at Georgetown. I was called and called, and nobody answered. And one night, a friend of mine came over for dinner. This is last week. And she said she brought her husband, who I had only met once and had never really spoken to. And it turns out that he's one of the world's greatest Yeats scholars and was going to Ireland tonight. I'm leaving tonight for a Yeats festival in Sligo, Ireland, and asked me to come with him. And it was so amazing that I had been trying to find somebody, because I certainly have read Yeats, but I'm not a scholar and I need tutorials. And so this whole trip just kind of ended up being planned around this Yeats festival and this guy who I had no idea was a Yeats scholar. And I don't think that that was a coincidence. I think that that's divine synchronicity. And so I think that's magic.
Absolutely. The Synchronicity of Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir, Sally Quinn's brand new book. And we'll be back with more of Sally after these words from the Om Times Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
A ranger station.
I'd like to report a bear hug.
Okay.
I put out my campfire and Smokey Bear hugged me.
So you drowned the fire, you stirred it, drowned it again, and felt that it was cold?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but he's just letting you know you did good.
Bear hug from Smokey Bear. Status update.
I'm gonna let you go now. There are many ways to start a fire, but one sure way to put it out. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
Sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service, Ad Council, and your state forester.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Sally Quinn, author of Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir. Sally, you talk about many intimate and personal stories connected with your developmental life and school years. And you talk about experiencing with casting hexes and the ramifications. Please share what that was like and what happened.
My mother, as I pointed out, was psychic, and when I was two, I had a dog named Blitzkrieg. My father was about to go off to war, and Blitzy got sick, and Mother took Blitzy to the vet, and he said, there's nothing wrong, and then back to the vet, nothing wrong, and so finally Blitzy looked like she was dying, and we took Blitzy to the vet, and the guy said, okay, I'll give you some medicine, put the dog in the car and come back. We went back to the car, Blitzy was dead, and my mother walked back into the vet's office and she said, I hope you drop dead. And he did shortly thereafter. Then I was in the hospital in Tokyo and during the Korean War, and I was sick. I was in the hospital for almost a year, and they had a rule that parents were not allowed to visit their children. And this was because there were so few nurses and they were taking in all these casualties from Korea that they found it disruptive when the parents would leave. And it was horrible. It was just absolutely a nightmare. And the pediatrician, the doctor who was head of this ward, absolutely was... He was a Nazi. I mean, he wouldn't let, ever, unless the child was actually dying, would not let the children come. And my mother tried to get in. She joined the Gray Ladies, which is a volunteer nursing aide, and she tried to get in, and he wouldn't let her. And finally, I was so sick that they sent me back to Brooke General Hospital in San Antonio, Texas, at Fort Sam Houston, on a military plane with a lot of wounded soldiers, which I describe in the book. And I was in the hospital in Fort Sam, and my mother was coming to see me. This is several months later, and she ran into this doctor, and she just looked at him, and she said, "I hope you drop dead," and apparently he did. This is according to my mother, shortly after that. So I had this sense that my mother had these powers, and I didn't know. But meanwhile, you know, I had this background of voodoo, my embedded religion that I had learned in Statesboro. And so there were, and I saw them practice the voodoo and saw them put hexes on people. And so I put three hexes on three different people. And one was when I was in my early 20s, and I went to a party, and there was this beautiful girl there, and I was with my boyfriend, and he just was entranced by her, and I could see he just immediately fall in love with her, and I was just sick to my stomach, and I looked to see if they'd exchanged numbers when they left, and I just knew that he was going to see her, and so what I wanted was for her to disappear, and so I decided I would try a hex. I'd never done it before, so I put a hex on her using some of the things that I had learned from the staff, the household staff. And about 3 days later, she committed suicide. And so I was completely undone by this. And I did not believe that I had done this. But there was a part of me that was terrified and just grief-stricken that I might have had something to do with it. And I told my brother, who got his PhD in religion from the University of Chicago and studied under Mircea Eliade, who was one of the great religion scholars in the country and did a lot of work in the area of the mysterious and the occult and mysticism. And my brother said, "You just got to stop doing it. You can't do this ever again." And then when I went to CBS News to be the first network anchor woman in America, I left the Washington Post, and the editor of New York Magazine, who I thought was a friend, ordered a cover story on me, which was the worst hatchet job that anybody has ever seen, and it was misquoted me and had all kinds of horrible things in there, and it totally turned around my time at CBS. I only lasted for about 6 months, and it was a disaster, and my reputation was destroyed, and from then on, everybody thought that I was this horrible person who had been depicted, and it just went on for a couple of years, and finally, I was so angry, I couldn't get over how much he had hurt me and hurt my reputation. I decided I would put a hex on him, and I did, and shortly after that, he got fired because the magazine, New York Magazine, was bought by somebody else in a hostile takeover, and his career never recovered from that, and later he died of cancer. Well, at this point, I told my brother, and he just went crazy, and he said, "Listen, you know, this is going to come back at you threefold if you do this. You cannot ever do this again." And again, my husband Ben thought it was totally ridiculous and a joke, and, you know, why was I even worried about it? And although sometimes he would joke, and he would say, well, if he got mad at somebody, he'd say, "Go get him, Sal," you know. But, and everybody else thought it was ridiculous too, and I didn't believe that I had these powers, but there was this embedded religion part of me that thought, "Oh my God, you know, could I possibly have had anything to do with that?" And then the last time was after my son Quinn was born, and I had hired a woman named Svetlana, Who was an astrologer, and I had gone to her, and she'd been quite fun. She was Russian, and she had a lot of personality and called everybody darling and was very exotic. And I had gotten her hired to do an astrology column at the Post to do horoscopes of various political leaders. It was very popular until she started using it for her own political views, and so we all agreed that she had to go, and they fired her, and she blamed me, and she said she was going to get back at me. But after my son Quinn was born with a heart defect, he had open heart surgery, this is about 6 months later, she called me, and he survived the surgery, and he was not expected to, and she said, she was all sweet, she said, darling, I'd love to give you a free reading of Quinn chart. And so I said, okay, fine. So I went over there, and she just was devastating. She said Quinn was going to be completely retarded, that he would never go to school, that he would never have friends, he would never have a life, he'd never have a job, he'd never have a relationship, and furthermore, he was gay. And about halfway through, I knew what she was doing, which is that she was trying to hurt me. She was trying to get back at me. And I was so outraged. I mean, Quinn was barely surviving at that point, and I was so undone by what was happening to him and his health. And I just thought that this was just evil, what she'd done. So I decided to put a hex on her. I didn't tell my brother, and I put a hex on her, and she dropped dead of a cerebral hemorrhage. I mean, I told several people about it, and they all died laughing, and they thought it was really funny. And the thing was that I never put a hex on anybody to have them die. I mean, with Clay Felker, the magazine editor, I just wanted him to feel the same kind of pain that he had caused me, which was, you know, a loss of reputation. And with Svetlana, I just wanted her to feel some kind of hurt, the kind of hurt that she had caused me, because it was just devastating to me. So I then, even though I didn't then, and I still do not now, believe that I'm responsible for these three things that happened, there's part of me that worries that maybe I was. And so I've never done it again. That was 35 years ago, and I never would do it again. Although I have to say, many times, a lot of my friends have asked me to. Yeah. But I have not done it, and I don't know. I mean, it would be interesting to know what you think and what your listeners think. Do you think I was responsible for this? I don't know.
I can't answer that question, and I wouldn't attempt to answer that question, but have you come to terms with these experiences?
Yes. Well, my brother said I had to make reparations, and so I did donate money to the suicide prevention program and the Heart Association and the Cancer Association. And I also vowed, I mean, in a spiritual way, that I would never try to hurt anybody again in any way. And I've tried to live up to that since then. And so I don't feel guilty anymore. But there's just a little thing in the back of my head that's always sort of there saying, and something which prevents me from doing it again, certainly.
Absolutely. What has your spiritual journey taught you?
Part of it is about wanting to be a good person and wanting to be a better person. And I think certainly studying religion and all faiths, which I started doing once I started the religion website on faith, was to learn about the different faiths of the world, the different religions, and to understand them. And I think everybody should do that. I think everybody should study religion in schools, the world religion, the way you study history or geography or psychology or psychiatry, I mean, you know, geography, anything, philosophy, because I think it's very important in understanding other people. And I have, I've become very pluralistic. I believe in anybody doing and believing what works for them. We all have different beliefs. I mean, you can walk into a church or a mosque or a synagogue with 3,000 people, and they all have a different relationship with the thing or the person they call God. And so I'm totally respectful of anyone's beliefs, no matter what they are, and whether they're occult or whether they're religious or Jews or Hindus or Muslims or Jains or Wiccans or whatever, as long as they don't hurt anyone. And so that has been my part of the thing that's been most important to me to learn, is to be respectful and accepting of other people's beliefs. And the other thing is, and also in trying to be a better person and trying to be understanding of other people, I think that I am now, God knows I'm not perfect, but I do think that I am much more sympathetic and more empathetic toward others than I ever was before in my life. And I also believe that the most important thing in life is love, and that you, without love, there's really nothing. You can't live without love. And so loving, the love of my parents, certainly, and my husband and my son, Quinn, who is the love of my life, and my family and my close friends, all of that has been enormously important to me. And I can't imagine living without love. And I think that if you experience love, I mean, I write in the book that, you know, my mother loved me so much. And when she died, I just felt this love coming into me, and it just came and came and came. And so I started giving it away, and I give it away and give it away and give it away. And I just am never on empty. I just keep getting refilled, because there's so much love out there to get and to give. And so for me, that's been the most important lesson of this experience I've had and writing this book.
And I would say that love is truly finding magic. Our guest, Sally Quinn, Finding Magic, a spiritual memoir. Sally, please tell our listeners one more time where they can get your book and find out more about your work.
My book will be published on September 12th. The publisher is Harper One. Should be in most bookstores in the United States, and you can already pre-order it on Amazon.
My guest, Sally Quinn, thank you so much for joining us. Finding Magic, an amazing read. I laughed, I cried, I felt very, very inspired by your book. Thank you so much for bringing this to us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.